Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Lily Walter, and I'm a senior anthropology and women's studies major here at Dickinson. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Anthropology Department, I would like to welcome you to this afternoon's event, Written on the Body, Hair and Heritage in Black Europe. France Windance Twine is a sociologist, feminist ethnographer, and critical race theorist who has conducted extensive fieldwork in Brazil, Britain, and the United States. She has taught at Colorado College, Duke University, University of Washington in Seattle, and is currently a women's studies and sociology professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Twine's articles on race, racism, and the intersections of race, class, and gender inequalities have been published in a wide range of international journals, including Ethnic and Racial Studies, Gender, Place, and Culture, and Meridians. Twine is the author of Racism in a Racial Democracy, published in 1997, and the editor of four volumes, including Feminism and Anti-Racism, International Struggles for Justice, published in 2001, and A White Side of Black Europe, forthcoming this year. Twine is also the deputy editor of the American Sociological Review, the flagship journal of the American Sociological Association. Twine's presentation today, Written on the Body, Hair and Heritage in Black Europe, discusses the black ethnic identities of children from racially mixed British families within second-generation African Caribbean communities. At this time, I would ask you to turn off all electronic devices. In addition, please hold on to any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a question and answer session. Because we are recording this program, and because some audience members are hearing impaired, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to be passed to you before asking your question. Also, I would like to invite you to two other events this afternoon. At 2:30 p.m., Professor Ann Hill will present Karen Kelski's paper, The Personal is Personal, Predicaments of a Lesbian Feminist Subject in Japan. The day will conclude with a panel discussion, including Twine and Hill, at 4:30 p.m. All the sessions will be held here in the Stern Center Great Room. We hope you will join us. And now, please join me in welcoming France Windance Twine.
I'd like to begin by thanking Heather Merrill, Karen Fries, Jolie Rankin, and everyone else who made my visit possible. I've never been to Pennsylvania before, so it's really great to be here. I'm just glad I made it here. So thank you very much for organizing this event. The talk that I'm going to give today is one that I've never given before, and it's based on research that I've done for my forthcoming book, which will be published later this year by Duke University Press. It's called A White Side of Black Britain. And this is based on research that I've been conducting for 10 years now. And let me just tell you a little bit about the larger project for those of you who aren't familiar with my work. I started going to England in 1996, and this started out as a comparative study of London, Liverpool, and Leicester, which are three cities located in three different areas of England. The talk I'm giving today is based on research from Leicester. Leicester is in what's called the East Midlands. It's 90 miles north of London. It historically was a hosiery manufacturing city. It was basically the center for shoe and boot production and distribution for England, and also hosiery manufacturing. And it's also historically important in terms of this conference for transnationalism. Leicester became the reception site for East African Asians in the late 1960s, primarily people who held British passports and were kicked out of Uganda and Kenya. And so there's a significant population from Uganda, Kenya, Malawi, and Tanzania. About 28% of the population is South Asian, and this occurred over roughly a 25-year period. And that's important because Leicester is now expected to be the first city in Europe with a non-white majority. That's the prediction if the demographics keep heading the way they are. Leicester's also interesting in that, so you had this transnational population of East African Asians who, basically from middle class background. And then you have nine different Caribbean islands represented. Well, in the 1960s, the African Caribbeans were the older ethnic population, and they had settled there first, right? And they became outnumbered. And now, when I went to England for the first time, which was in 96, South Asians, particularly with origins in East Africa as opposed to in India, outnumber African Caribbeans 10 to 1. That's relevant in terms of how people conceptualize what it means to be black and or African and to be part of an African diaspora, since a significant part of the African diaspora population in Leicester is actually South Asian. Does that make sense? So that's really important both politically, because in England, I would say until the 1980s, the term black was an elastic term that was used very differently from how we use it in this country, and black included almost anybody from a former colony except the Chinese. So the term black is still used in the community to refer to people from who are South Asian in origin and Caribbean and or African, but it doesn't include the Chinese. What that means is that at different moments, the term black and or African is negotiated, right, and what it means is contested over. So I just want to just give you that little bit of background before I begin. I want to start by reading a quote by Toby Miller, a British cultural theorist, on cultural citizenship, because much of my work is actually looking at what does it mean to belong. And what does it mean to belong in a community when you have two parents who are from different national origins and or different class positions? So I'm going to begin with this quote from Cultural Citizenship to kind of situate it. We are in a crisis of belonging, a population crisis of who, what, when, and where. More and more people feel as though they do not belong. More and more people are seeking to belong, and more people are not counted as belonging. My talk today is about the forms of labor that white birth mothers of children of African Caribbean descent engage in to secure their children's belonging in a diasporic community in which what it means to be black and to perform as black is highly contested. It's contested because often what is authorized as black is specifically class-linked and dominated by Jamaican Brits. Okay, so this is a community in which people of Jamaican background are viewed as having more power, even though they're outnumbered by people from Trinidad, Barbados, and Antigua. And there's also a more recent migration from Somalia. Okay. So that just so basically, one of the things I'm going to be talking about that's a link to the talk you heard this morning by Professor Brennan is the issue of consumption, how consumption is employed strategically by members of multiracial families to secure belonging, performance, and particularly the body as a corporal canvas. So I'm going to be talking about how the body, particularly the female body, of young women whose mothers, birth mothers are white, so I'm not talking about adoptive mothers, how their mothers and themselves basically try to negotiate their belonging, okay? And I'm gonna start, and the other thing I want to say as an aside is in this larger body of work, I take U.S. black feminist theory and it's in dialogue with European theorists, such as Pierre Bourdieu and others, including Antonio Gramsci and Durkheim. So the other thing I'm trying to do is bring into dialogue European theorists and U.S. black theorists, black and non-black feminist theorists, to theorize kind of how people negotiate racial and ethnic boundaries. So that's what the larger project is about. Between 1963 and 1968, French social theorist Pierre Bourdieu and his research associates distributed 1,217 questionnaires to individuals living in Paris, Lille, and a provincial town. These questionnaires were a survey of lifestyles, and they were designed to provide a systematic analysis of the cultural profiles of the French. They included 25 questions on cultural taste in cooking, interior decoration, clothing, reading, cinema, painting, music, photography, radio, and other leisure activities. The aim of this survey was to determine how a cultivated disposition and cultural competence were demonstrated in the types and qualities of goods consumed by the French. I'm beginning with Bourdieu because I'm going to use Bourdieu's concept of capital, which refers to power, to show how cultural distinctions are produced in everyday practices. The distinctions that I'm going to talk about today are how do members of multiracial families prove that they are trying to live an authentic black lifestyle. Does that make sense? In the context of a town in central England. In Bourdieu's conceptual framework, there are specific forms of capital, which is power, at stake in all social fields. A field is basically a space of conflict and competition, the analogy here being with a battlefield in which participants vie to establish monopoly over the species of capital effective in it and the power to decree the hierarchy and conversion rates between all forms of authority. In other words, we all operate in social fields and we have different forms of power that we're trying to negotiate. Okay, so the field that I'm going to be talking about today is a field in which you have white birth mothers raising their daughters, black sisters-in-law, black mothers-in-law, black friends, and the white members of the family are trying to show that they are culturally competent. And one of the ways they show it is that they're showing that, look, I know what kind of performance that my daughter has to give in order to be accepted, right, within this particular working class community as black and to be affirmed. So, and that gives her more power. Individuals, according to Bourdieu, struggle over various forms of capital and fields of relations. These forms of capital can be divided into four categories: economic, social, cultural. Cultural is what we call legitimate knowledge, which is what you're learning here at the university. Symbolic capital, which is prestige and social honor. Now, Bourdieu was not specifically interested in race or the ways that racial hierarchy structure fields or racism. Nevertheless, his concept of capital and his concept of a field is useful when we analyze how members of interracial families, and I'm referring to families that are black, white, not including Asians, negotiate blackness and learn to consume products that are associated with racialized positions. White mothers, according to the 1991 census, so when I went to England, I was relying on the 1991 UK data. At that time, 50% of UK-born black men had a white partner. What that meant was that 40% of children under the age of 10 who were considered to be multiracial, having a black parent, father, 40% had a white mother. That's much higher than the U.S., and what that means is that if we look at multiracial families in the U.K., particularly black-white, they're more comparable to Asian Americans in terms of the out-marriage rate. So Asian Americans are more comparable to black Brits in terms of their out-marriage rate, whereas Asians, South Asians in the community I was in are more comparable to U.S. blacks. I use the term U.S. blacks, not African American. I use the term African American to refer to immigrants from Africa who migrated during their lifetime and maintain a cultural connection. So in my talk, I will not use the term African American unless I'm referring to someone from Africa as opposed to someone who grew up here, was born here, and been here several generations. Okay, so the point is that if you look at the state school system in this community, the majority of children who are labeled black, multi-mixed black, or black other have a white parent. That's more common than having two black parents. Does that make sense? So children who may be socially classified as black are more likely in this community to have a white parent, and that parent is more likely to be a mother, the white parent. So this is what we call a normative experience. This is not a deviant experience in this community from the perspective of blacks. White mothers and grandmothers parenting children of African and Caribbean descent play a pivotal role in the cultivation and transfer of cultural capital to their children. The acquisition of cultural competency in black, African, and Caribbean diasporic communities requires members of these families to move between fields and communities that are racialized. This includes learning distinct sets of cultural skills and also specific tastes that enable them to meet criteria for inclusion in black communities. In the case of Lester, members of the community calculated belonging and determined criteria for inclusion and exclusion based on tastes in music, food, clothing, language, and hairstyle. This is not unique to the UK, right? We do the same thing in this country, right? Music, the kind of music you listen to is an important, right, part of your identity. And so these forms of capital that I'm going to talk about today were not typically a product of formal education in schools, but were typically acquired informally and through social networks. The borders that distinguish African Caribbean culture from, quote, English culture are permeable and a product of daily labor in which ethnic differences are performed and produced through specific practices. The symbolic and material content of blackness, whiteness, and Englishness is fought over and contested, particularly in the post-World War II period. Beginning after the World War II, there was a lot of migration to England, and the demographics of the major cities changed. In this case, I'm thinking mainly of Birmingham, Manchester, London. And so you had the urban landscape change dramatically. And so what's considered English today is not equivalent to what was considered English 30 or 40 years ago. An example of that would be just what the food people eat. Most people do eat curry, for example, at least once a week, which wouldn't have been the case in the 1960s. Okay, one of the things that I'm doing today in this paper is I'm extending Bourdieu's concept of capital to include a fifth form of capital that I uncovered that I'm referring to as ethnic capital. Ethnic capital refers to forms of cultural capital valued by the black community and that enables individuals who are classified as either outside or on the margins of a black ethnic group due to their multiracial origins to reposition themselves. This form of capital is crucial and is used by white parents to assist their children in responding to racism and racialization. Okay, what I'm going to argue right now is that one way that, and I'm focusing on the mothers here, but in the larger project, I also included black fathers and white fathers, but today, in this particular talk, I'm not going to be focusing on the fathers. I'm going to argue that one way that white transracial mothers secure their children's belonging is by acquiring forms of capital that require them to consume particular products and services, okay? And these products and services are part of a transnational circuit. And I'm going to focus on hair in particular because that emerged as one issue that was central, particularly for girls. I'm employing the term transracial here rather than interracial to reflect the constant social movements between different and competing cultural repertoires, cultural prescriptions, and social worlds that can appear to resemble glass walls. Glass walls both divide and separate while allowing one to see what is on the other side. Okay, we know from feminist theory that gender regimes and racial subjectivities, as well as class hierarchies, are reproduced on the body. I'm thinking here of the work of Judith Butler, Susan Bourdieu, and Carolyn Knowles. So the body has always been an important site for the reproduction of power and status distinctions, right? And we know this from feminist work. Constrained by local culture, economic resources, and parental decisions about the selection and consumption of food, hair care, skin products, and other household items reinforce and reproduce ethnic boundaries and racial logics. So I'm going to talk about consumption strategies. And these are strategies in which parents make specific decisions about what they consume, but these decisions are linked to the meaning and performance of blackness and respectability. What is at stake in these families is which aspects of the parents, particularly the black parents' cultural repertoire, are transferred to the next generation. And I'm going to explore two sites today, home cooking and hair. Okay. This section that I'm going to go over now is called The Global Hair Care Market, Black Markets and Consumer Circuits. And I'm starting with this because I want to place emphasis on the transnational aspect of hair care and how this is a really important market internationally. The ethnic personal care market is estimated to be a $5.1 billion market, of which $1.6 billion is in retail. The rest is in professional products and body care services. We know that black women in the United States, for example, spend 2 to 3 times more on their hair when compared to white women. During the late 1990s, European firms began to buy out U.S. black family-owned hair care companies, which held the global market share in what's called the ethnic hair and beauty market. The competition for black hair care dollars became more intensive, and black families based in Chicago, who essentially created the black hair care market and designed innovative products during the period 1954 to 1990, began to see their sales decline as Revlon and other European-American companies that had previously targeted primarily white and European consumers turn their attention to blacks and other ethnic groups. And we see that when we saw Queen Latifah and a number of other black celebrities started to be hired by Revlon in the 1990s to advertise their campaign. Prior to that, and also a few black models, prior to that, the quote mainstream the mainstream beauty and cosmetic companies had pretty much ignored, quote, the black market. Chicago is the birthplace of the global ethnic hair care market. During the post-World War II period, two U.S. black families in Chicago, the Gardners and the Johnsons, developed hair care products to address the needs of working class and middle class blacks who had been ignored by the mainstream firms that catered exclusively to an imagined white community. And aside is that Italian Americans and other white ethnics often purchased these hair care products, but the assumption was by the mainstream companies that all whites had the same kind of hair and, you know, needed the same product. These black family-owned businesses established products that became the foundation of today's global ethnic market in hair and skin care. These companies developed innovative products and services for U.S. blacks during an era of racially segregated and parallel markets. Okay. Founded in 1964 in the basement of the home of Edward and Betty Ann Gardner, a black family living in a middle-class segregated community on Chicago's South Side, Soft Sheen was established and became the second largest manufacturer of ethnic hair care in the world. Edward and Betty Ann Gardner tested the products on their children's hair and developed a company that competed directly with Johnson Products, also based on the South Side of Chicago, which was the world's largest producer of black hair care products. Soft Sheen marketed its products to specialist retailers and hairdressing salons. When it was purchased in 1997 by L'Oreal, a French firm, its major brands included Optimum, Carefree Curl, and Alternatives. When it was purchased in 97, Soft Sheen exported its products to Canada, the United Kingdom, West Africa, and Caribbean. Its gross sales at that time were close to $80 million. Now, many of you in this room are probably too young to remember the Jerry Curl, which was introduced in the 1980s by Soft Sheen. Do you remember that? You guys weren't born then, were you? So anyway, you know that Michael Jackson popularized the Jerry Curl style. Well, what happened in the 1980s is that consumer trends started to change in the late 1980s, and Soft Sheen began to experience a decline in its growth. So in order to compensate for diminishing domestic sales, Soft Sheen began a rapid expansion overseas and began to target Europe, Western Europe, Africa, and the Caribbean. And Soft Sheen actually purchased 66% of Dyke and Dryden, which was a London-based manufacturer of ethnic care products, and at that time was the largest black-owned business in Europe. This gave Soft Sheen entry into a global market of approximately, so we're talking in late 80s, approximately 440 million consumers in Africa, the Caribbean, North America, and Western Europe. But what happened in the 1990s, as I said, is that the Europeans and European Americans began to realize, wow, we can make a lot of money in ethnic hair care. And so in 1993, Johnson Products was sold to the Ivex Corporation, which was a Miami-based company. 5 years later, the French company L'Oreal bought Soft Sheen for an undisclosed amount. L'Oreal then hired Leila Ali, a boxer like her father, Muhammad Ali, to launch a new promotional campaign after it opened its new Center for Research and Development on Ethnic and Hair Care on the south side of Chicago. In 2000, L'Oreal opened the L'Oreal Institute for Ethnic Hair and Skin Research on Chicago's south side, which is the world's only state-of-the-art research center for ethnic skin and hair. L'Oreal devotes one-third of its $360 million annual budget to research on black hair and skin care. Why am I spending so much time on the numbers? Because I want to convince you that hair matters and that the Europeans, particularly in this case L'Oreal, realized that if they wanted to control the global market, they had to buy up companies founded in the Midwest by Americans, because that's how they're going to maintain dominance over this market. Does that make sense? So I'm not trying to bore you with these numbers, but these numbers are really important. The significant capital that L'Oreal has invested in its Center for Research and Development illustrates the centrality and economic importance of the ethnic market to the growth and continued market dominance of L'Oreal. The chief corporate officers clearly view African and Asian diasporic communities in Europe, as well as blacks on the African continent, as a vital segment of their international markets, particularly since there is limited growth in an already saturated North American market. Furthermore, market research has shown that blacks in the Caribbean and Africa, and increasingly in Europe, are beginning to spend significantly more dollars and a higher percentage of their income on hair and beauty care. Okay, so I'm basically trying to establish for you the importance of this hair care in terms of the African and Asian diaspora in Europe and how that is now being targeted. And U.S. blacks have lost control of that market. So companies established here in the post-World War II period have been bought up by the Europeans. But this is now part of a transnational circuit that I'm now going to move back to England where these products are being sold. I'm holding a copy of an English birth certificate. This certificate was filed on January 13, 1992. The name of the child is listed as Eshe Taliba Mitchell. On December 19, 1991, Helena Mitchell, her mother, a white native of Leicester, England, gave birth to her first child, a daughter fathered by a Nigerian. She named her Eshe, which is the Swahili word for life. Helena terminated her relationship with Eshe's father during the second trimester of her pregnancy, and since her birth, Helena has raised Eshe with the active involvement and support of her mother, Anita O'Reilly. As an unmarried woman, Helena would most likely be classified as a single or lone mother in British social service records, but she is not alone. Helena Mitchell belongs to a rapidly growing cohort of white mothers who are members of black transnational families whose relatives live in New York, Vienna, Toronto, as well as London. Invested in her African genealogy and heritage, Eshe's mother and grandmother have made a commitment to transfer and translate the meanings of her Nigerian heritage to her in a community in which tensions and conflicts exist between Africans, so Africans I'm referring to people born in Africa, and UK-born people of Caribbean and African heritage. This is a community in which Eshe has few peers or playmates of her background. Her social networks, and it's because she has an African father as opposed to a Caribbean father, so that makes it more complicated because the majority of children of multiracial heritage have a Caribbean father, okay? So I'm using this example just to show you how complex this is. Her social network consists primarily of children of Caribbean and East African Asian origin. Although her mother, Helena, shares some of the same struggles against racism as the black mothers of children of African heritage, they remain in the shadows of black Britain. One of the things that I'm trying to do here is make visible a group of women who've been silenced and remain relatively mute in the black British cultural studies literature, despite their significance. In my discussions with white and black members of British interracial families, I interviewed 108 members of interracial families repeatedly over a 10-year period. Okay, so I would go back and I also conducted field research. So this data is from 108 families. I discovered that the ethnic identities and racialized positions of family members of multiracial heritage, particularly girls and women, were partially managed through the arrangement, styling of their daughters' hair and clothing. Hair is biological material that can be culturally manipulated, transformed, and shaped to project an identity, a social position, and to cement social relationships. Furthermore, among the British transracial families I studied, it's not simply a girl's identity, but the respectability of her birth mother that is at stake. For example, it is often assumed erroneously, what I call a racial fiction, that white women do not know how to care for the hair of their children. And there were a lot of stereotypes that circulate about kind of what constitutes appropriate hair care. In conversations with black sisters-in-law and the black husbands of white transracial mothers, hair was identified as central to definitions of blackness, and white family members were often evaluated and ranked on the basis of cultural knowledge of hair grooming. The cleaning, conditioning, cutting, styling, and daily management of hair was described by black family members as a definitive arena in which respectability, morality, and authority was asserted. Black women invested intense efforts into socializing their white sisters-in-law and friends to purchase services and products that positioned children of multiracial heritage as members of working-class black and upwardly mobile communities. Now, this is a particular problem if you're a single mother and you don't have a black sister-in-law, right? Because then you need a black friend or some other associate to legitimate you or authorize you. The issue of hair care was a repeated theme in an arena of struggle and discussions and private conversations with the black sisters-in-law of white women. As they describe their relationships with their white sisters-in-law and their nieces of multiracial heritage, they invariably pointed to hair as evidence of either cultural competence or failure. I apologize for not having photographs. I've been working with an Irish photographer for 6 years, and he produced about 1,600 photographs, but some of my luggage was misplaced, probably by Homeland Security, on my way here, so I apologize for not having the photos to show you. Black British cultural theorist Cobaina Mercer extends earlier work on subcultures by conceptualizing black hairstyling as, quote, a popular art form articulating a variety of aesthetic solutions to a range of problems created by ideologies of race and racism. He then maps the unnaturalness of hair. In Mercer's words, quote, As organic matter produced by physiological processes, human hair seems to be a natural aspect of the body. Yet hair is never a straightforward biological fact because it is almost always groomed, prepared, cut, concealed, and generally worked upon by human hands. Such practices socialize hair, making it the medium of significant statements about self, society, and the codes of value that bind them or do not. In this way, hair is merely raw material constantly processed by cultural practices, which thus invest it with meanings and value. I'm taking that from Welcome to the Ghetto is the name of that collection. In an analysis of U.S. black women's conceptualization of hair and hairstyling practices, Ingrid Banks, a black sociologist, argues that, quote, black hair in general has not escaped political readings about how blacks construct identities as well as how whites construct identities about blacks by reading the biological, that is hair, through a sociopolitical lens. Particular hairstyles display a black aesthetic that is linked to an authentic or radical blackness in the imagination of many whites. In focus groups with U.S. black women of diverse ages, Ingrid Banks found that women distinguished between good and bad hair and also argued that hairstyles signal specific lifestyle choices and social networks. In other words, black women clarified that hair had a crucial social aspect, that is, its significance in attracting and sustaining friendships with particular types of people. In her words, quote, this is the words of an informant from Ingrid Banks, depending on who you want to socialize with dictates pretty much what kind of hair, what kind of style you have to wear. End of quote. Like the U.S. black women interviewed by Banks, I found that in England, hairstyles and grooming practices were also crucial in securing membership in specific friendship networks. Black British women, so women who self-identify as black British, but who are of black African and white English or Irish heritage, I also want to say 12% of the women I interviewed were Irish. But they lived in England, but they were of Irish origin. Black women of white, English, or Irish heritage often employed hairstyles as a way to affirm their relationships with their darker-skinned family members and with their peers of African and or Caribbean ancestry. In the case of Eshe, having her hair professionally braided by a black woman identifies her as a member not only of the local black diasporic community, but it strengthens her cultural bonds with her black female girlfriends. Braids encode onto her body, the body of the birth daughter of a white English mother, her public identification with black people of a transnational origin. Furthermore, by engaging in a cultural practice associated with an African or black lifestyle, she legitimates herself as a black woman with a white mother. By frequenting a black-owned salon with her mother, Eshe also practices a particular version of black femininity and secures her belonging while erasing crucial cultural differences between her genealogy and her social life and that of her black girlfriends of exclusively African and or Caribbean parentage. In other words, in this community, hairstyles, and particularly braids or dreadlocks, help young women like Eshe to secure her position in the black box as well as among her peer group. Now, I want to comment. One of the things that's happening here is Eshe and her mother are under pressure to conform to homogenized notions of blackness, right? So if we listen to black British cultural theorists, and I'm going to quote now from Debbie Weeks, she argues that creating essentialized identities on the basis of skin color and hair texture places many mixed parentage individuals on the boundaries of blackness. This is relevant to young mixed parentage women in my research because many were preoccupied with their shades of skin. And this had differing effects on the young women in terms of how they view black women. In other words, black feminists in Britain have argued that this homogenization can also be damaging to young women of mixed heritage because they're often, if they don't conform to a narrow range of skin type and phenotype, they have to compensate for that. And they have, and one way they compensate is by adopting styles that are viewed as more radical or not viewed as European. But it's complicated because the argument is that this is also can strategically empower them. So once again, if we link it to the talk earlier today, family members argued both that they were empowering their daughter strategically, but other people argued outside of the family that this was actually disempowering them by forcing them to conform to a very rigid aesthetic regime. Okay. Weekly and bimonthly trips to black-owned hair salons also enables Eshe's mother, Helena, to establish her reputation as a cultural equivalent or cultural clone of a black mother who knows how to care for her daughter's hair properly. Whether Eshe chooses to wear her hair braided in elaborate patterns, straight backs, or have her hair chemically straightened, as she did recently, it is always done at a black salon by black women who style her hair for daily wear as well as for holidays and special occasions. Eshe's Nigerian heritage is literally inscribed onto her body via her braids. If I had the photographs, you would be able to see that she looks really different with the braids. Like without the braids, she could pass for what we would call in this country Middle Eastern or Arab American, you know, like more ambiguous, more of those groups that are in between the space between black and white. Whereas when she has her hair braided, it does really visually reposition her. Eshe's hairstyle declares to the black and non-black community that she is living an authentic black life. Specific demands are placed upon the bodies of light-skinned daughters of white English and Irish mothers, particularly those who are actively cultivating their African English identities. As a young woman whose facial features may position her slightly outside of narrow definitions of blackness, Eshe's hairstyle is a crucial ethnic marker. Braids enable her to assert and establish racial authenticity through a stylistic convention that is strongly associated with blackness. It also helps her secure her sense of belonging by conforming to popular and commercialized versions of blackness. Also, let me just say that in contrast to the U.S., which most of you know has a very rigid one-drop rule, in England, they never legally define blackness, and race is not listed on your birth certificate. So in contrast to the U.S., that actually creates more space, right, for people, despite how they look physically, to socially negotiate their identity because they're not, quote, registered officially by the state as an X, Y, or Z on their birth certificate. So that is very different from our system. British sociologists studying the discursive and stylistic repertoires of young children and youth have argued that the body plays a central role in the ways that racial, ethnic, and class identities are managed and boundaries form. Suki Ali, a British sociologist who has studied the discursive repertoires and the visual language of young children aged 8 to 11 years of mixed race heritage in London, argues that, quote, her book is called Post-Race Mixed Race, for those of you interested, argues that for girls, the reading of attractiveness and whether it was raced or not was often articulated through hairstyles. Conventional studies of racialized beauty standards produce results which, I suggest, this is Ali speaking, form a constraining continuum for both conventional and so-called counter-hegemonic readings. For black women, natural blackness is the only possible counter-hegemonic form of authentic beauty, and anything that utilizes so-called whitening processes is inauthentic, end of quote. So Ali is arguing, based on her research among children of multiracial heritage, that girls in middle school strategically manipulated their hairstyles to prove whether they were black or not and to be accepted into specific friendship networks. And these are young girls. These are very young girls. So one of the things she argues in her book is that young girls who were marginalized or weren't as popular would immediately change their hairstyle to get accepted, which is not news, right? But in this case has racial implications. If you belong to an ethnic minority and you want to be accepted by that minority group. Susan Osman has analyzed the culture of intimacy and femininity in beauty salons in Cairo, Casablanca, and Paris. Describing the job of the hairstylist, Osman notes that, quote, her job is to allow women to move gracefully through the webs, not of meaning, but of engagements with others who are known and whose judgments count, end of quote. In the case of young girls like Ashe, the judgments that count are those of Ashe's black girlfriends, their black mothers, and her black aunts and members of the local community. These are the people who evaluate Ashe's hair as a marker of belonging, of maternal competence, and of respectability. I'm also drawing on the work of Beverly Skeggs here, who's a British feminist scholar. Ashe's mother, Helena, aligns herself with the black mothers of her daughter's friends by demonstrating a strong public commitment to black cultural styles. But she's also doing something else. She's taking her daughter to this hair salon. This hair salon is actually a transnational cultural space where women from Africa, but primarily East Africa, West Africa, Caribbean women, all go, and she's giving Ashe a, quote, black experience, albeit one mediated. And so in some extent, she's trying to give her daughter an experience and also expose her to black transnational discourses about appropriate femininity. Taking her daughter to black hair salons is one way that Helena trains her daughter to not only identify with her Nigerian ancestry, but to also privilege her body as a corporal canvas upon which to stylishly display her African heritage. For Helena and her daughters, salons owned and operated by local black women provide a space for her daughter to, quote, become black and to form a racialized feminine identity that homogenizes and commercializes blackness by erasing crucial ethnic differences between West Africans, West Indians, and UK-born black British people. This bimonthly ritual reinforces Eshe's status as black with a white mother and reinforces the boundaries between Eshe and English girls of no known African heritage. For teenage girls who belong to multiracial families where the white parent is the most visible and the most involved in daily care, hairstyles are a particular type of body project that can serve as a powerful statement of allegiance and in some cases compensate for an absent black parent. It is also how they learn to, quote, write their identities onto their bodies and thus establish ethnic boundaries between themselves and others. Now, we all write our identities onto our bodies, right? But the consequences here are very specific. Where do I want to go now? How much time do I have? I can't see the clock over there. I need to stop in 10 minutes. Okay, guys, thank you. I'm used to teaching 2-hour classes, so unfortunately, guys, I can talk on and on and on. Okay, let me move forward here. Okay, this section is called Culinary Capital, Heritage Cuisine as Ethnic Capital, and I'll try to finish by 2. In a comparative analysis, so I've just talked about hair, now I'm moving to food. So what you put into your body. Okay. In a comparative analysis of working class and bourgeois lifestyles, Pierre Bourdieu systematically analyzed the differences in the patterns and structure of consumption of various food items. Bourdieu identified 3 structures of consumption as distributed under 3 items: food, culture, and presentation. Presentation for the French, in this case, meant clothing, beauty, care, toiletries, and domestic servants. According to Bourdieu, eating habits cannot, of course, be considered independently of the whole lifestyle. The most obvious reason for this is that the taste for particular dishes is associated through preparation and cooking with a whole conception of the domestic economy and the division of labor between the sexes. Now, what I did is I followed Bourdieu's model. I selected 5 families that allowed me to shadow them as they did their weekly grocery and household shopping. And what I was interested in was observing patterns of consumption. And then I compared them on a spectrum of black identification. And what I discovered was distinctive patterns of consumption associated with particular racialized lifestyles. And so among those white transracial mothers who expressed a strong identification with blacks, and particularly with African or Caribbean culture, these women tended to invest more time and spend more of their weekly income purchasing ethnic foods, so foods that target an ethnic audience. They prepared labor-intensive dishes that required overnight seasoning and adhered to a specific set of rules regarding hygiene, spice, and cooking. These meals required white mothers to demonstrate that they had acquired forms of culinary knowledge valued by blacks of Caribbean or African origin, and thus constituted within the home a form of cultural capital that distinguished them from white women who cooked exclusively English food. This cooking, what I call heritage cooking, involved the intergenerational transfer of ethnic capital in the form of taste. Now, for those of you who've read Bourdieu, you'll know that he wrote this huge book called Distinctions, and one of the things he's interested in is how tastes are produced. And these tastes link us, these tastes give us certain forms of power, but also position us within a hierarchy. So white women who learned to cook, quote, heritage food, were able to shape their children's taste in a way that signified to their family that they were maintaining their cultural ties to the black community. The consumption and preparation of ethnic food as a cultural practice enabled white transracial mothers to achieve respectability and acceptance among their black family members, while also, once again, positioning themselves as the cultural equivalents of black women and their extended families. The Caribbean Supermarket is located on the corner of St. Stephen's Road and Guilford Road in the heart of Highfields. This supermarket has operated for 30 years. It was established by an African Asian Indian of Kenyan origin who sold it in 1999 to a Bangladeshi. The Caribbean Supermarket is the central institution for the Black Caribbean and African diasporic communities in Leicester because it provides easy access to fresh, canned and packaged ingredients required to prepare West Indian, West African, or East African cuisine. The white women and black men in this study who cook black food all reported that they shop regularly at this market. So I went to this market myself and I interviewed the owners and visited. Now, this is when I wish I could show you a photograph. So just imagine what I'm describing. A series of color advertisements posted on the front of the store reflect the clientele's desire for one-stop shopping. On the front of the store are 9 glossy posters that advertise U.S.-made black hair care products. Some of these products are what we call relaxers that chemically straighten hair. To the left of the entrance of the store are 3 large soft sheen posters of U.S. black women who have silky straight hair showing the benefits of using their products. There's also an orange handwritten sign in black letters that contrasts with the glossy commercial U.S. advertisements, and this sign reads, "English pony hair from Zimbabwe/Kenya is available now." Now, I didn't know what pony hair was. I have to say I had to be educated on this. Pony hair is actually human hair that you buy that can be worn as a ponytail, okay? And so human hair that can be attached and worn as ponytails are sold in a range of colors and types and can be found behind the counter in this store at the opposite end from the dry goods, such as corn, meal, rice, beans, pastas, and spices. These products are shipped via Africa and Asia from an Asian Indian distributor based in London. So once again, we see this network, right? So you have this, you have hair from Kenya, Uganda. The most expensive hair is from Asia. The African hair, of course, is not as expensive. So this hair is purchased and distributed by Asian Indians via London. Kasim Haki, the son of the current owner, earned his degree in chemistry from University College London. He comes up from London on the weekends to help his father run the store. In an interview with me, he described his clientele in this way. He informed me that 50% of his customer base are real Africans, which are those born in Africa as opposed to UK-born people of African Caribbean heritage who self-identify as African. So he's making a distinction, right? He also confirmed that 30% of his clientele were multiracial families that included a white mother. During a tour of the store, Kasim described the national origins of all of the various dry goods and other products. Pointing to a 1.5-pound bag of maize meal, Kasim says, "This is for the Zimbabweans and Kenyans. This is why the Kenyans can run so fast." He explains that this is energy food. There are rows and rows of 45-kilo bags containing a colorful range of beans in the corner next to a refrigerated case of water and soda. He shows me gungo peas from West India, white beans from the U.S., kidney beans, crab eye beans, Great Northern. There is long grain rice and easy cook rice. As we walk past the tightly packed aisles, Kasim described the various dry goods that he carries, and he emphasized the diverse national origins of his African customer base. Essentially, what you see in this store is you see the black transatlantic world, basically. I mean, you basically see products, cornmeal from the U.S., pepper sauce from Barbados, maize flour, Jamaican ginger beer. So this was a global market where transnational identities and tastes were satisfied. Rows of human hair in all colors, textures, and lengths also hung on the wall across from the dry goods. So this Caribbean market that I'm describing, which was within walking distance about one quarter of the families that participated, is a sociocultural resource that provides white transracial mothers and other members of multiracial families with the ingredients required to prepare meals that are similar or identical to those of African and or Caribbean black women. By adapting the culinary tastes and learning the spice regimes and flavor spectrums of their black mothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, white women hope to secure not only approval and affirmation from black family members, but train their children to acquire specific tastes. And those tastes were a form of capital, ethnic capital. White women who had convinced themselves that they were running a black household evaluated themselves on the basis of how closely their cooking approximated that of their Caribbean-born family members. I'm going to skip on so I can. Okay, so essentially what I'm arguing here is that in those families in which the white mothers felt that the black women were their reference group or their referent, they viewed cooking and basically they viewed training their children to eat specific foods and learning to cook those were essential to them being able to belong or fit into this community, because they needed to be able not only to recognize these foods from Africa and the Caribbean, but know how they should taste, the proper taste. And this was once again producing an ethnic boundary, but and also proving that their children were living, quote, a black lifestyle, that they were running a black household. I'm going to move on. I'm going to skip the last section so that I can get to the conclusion, so I can leave time for questions and answers. So I'm skipping a little section here. Okay. In an analysis of the ideals of love among U.S. white middle class couples, Ann Switler, a Berkeley sociologist, argues for new metaphors to understand how culture works. Switler argues that, quote, perhaps we do best to think of culture as a repertoire, like that of an actor, a musician, or a dancer. This image suggests that culture cultivates skills and habits in its users so that one can be more or less good at the cultural repertoire one performs, and that such cultured capacities may exist both as discrete skills, habits, and orientations, and in larger assemblages, like the pieces a musician has mastered or the plays an actor has performed. It is in this sense that people have an array of cultural resources upon which they can draw. Switler's concept of a cultural repertoire is useful when considering the culinary skills and the habitus that white English women and Irish women acquire as members of black extended families who have transnational origins in the Caribbean, Africa, and the U.S. These women learn cultural skills common among Caribbean families, such as seasoning meats, washing and preparing foods properly, and training their children to display formal respect and authority to their elders. So one of the things that I'm trying to argue here is how these skills or this cultural repertoire has actually, these sorts of skills have been ignored by sociologists in particular who are analyzing diasporic communities in the UK. They often erase these forms of labor that occur in kitchens and in homes, and they don't look at the significance of this for the reproduction of a second or third generation community, particularly among people who may or may not acquire, quote, a black British identity. So I'm arguing that we need to consider these skills as part of a gender regime and a consumption regime that plays a crucial role in whether children see themselves as part of a black British community and how they learn to identify as part of that community. And it's also linked to middle class and commercialized versions of respectability. Floya Antheus and Neera Yuval Davis have argued that gender is central to the production and maintenance of ethnic identities and boundaries. They are instructive in their analysis. Quote, the boundary of the ethnic is often dependent on gender, and there is a reliance on gender attributes for specifying ethnic identity. Much of ethnic culture is organized around rules relating to sexuality, marriage, and the family, and a true member will perform these roles properly. Communal boundaries often use differences in the way women are socially constructed as markers, and such markers symbolize the use of women as an ethnic resource. End of quote. I'm arguing here that white members, particularly mothers, who belong to transracial and transnational families are an ethnic resource for the black members of their family and for children of multiracial heritage. In other words, they often take the role of black women culturally as cultural equivalents, and that this is actually central in communities where you have a very small black population or you have a black population that doesn't feel they are very visible. So white members of these families who have a strong identification with their black female relatives serve not only as ethnic resources but an ethnic boundary. They actually serve as a black ethnic boundary for the family by performing these roles. By purchasing consumer products targeted to an ethnic market and by adopting the consumption regime of their black relatives, they assert what I term a black signature in a multiracial household. This signature or cultural style distinguished them from white transracial mothers who neither embraced the black aesthetic nor believed that they needed to transfer these particular forms of cultural capital. The negotiation of racial and ethnic boundaries in late capitalist cultures demands that white mothers who want to integrate their children culturally into transnational black networks may find they're required to train them, their children and themselves to strongly identify with class-specific and commercialized versions of blackness. Transracial mothers who adopt local folk understandings of black cultural style sometimes recycle rather than resist racial logics that naturalize and homogenize blackness. Their desire to help their children achieve cultural fluency and belonging in black British diasporic communities may require them to reproduce specific versions of blackness that have been authorized by family members, transnational corporations, as well as members of local communities. Contests over the meaning and performance of blackness are acted out in hair salons, kitchens, dining rooms, bathrooms, and bedrooms. Okay. I apologize. I had to leave out one section, so. So, Heather, do I take questions? Okay. Oh, great.
Great, thank you. I was just wondering if you kind of touched on this briefly, but I was wondering if you could talk a little more in depth about the influence of class on projecting a black identity as well.
Okay.
Just as far as, you know, buying products and playing into that whole aspect of it.
Basically, that's a really great question, and I didn't talk a lot about class. In this particular community, the majority of the black community would be classified as working class based on wealth and occupation. And therefore, working class black culture has been idealized and glamorized and specific. So anything that is associated with middle-class blacks is seen as less authentic. And what that means is that often it presents conflicts and contradictions for families that view themselves as upwardly mobile. And one of the things that I didn't talk about was how in some of these families, the white mother will go out and learn all of these, quote, authentic things, only to be challenged by her black partner, who's upwardly mobile, that well, no, that's not English enough, and that's too. So essentially there's an idealization of working class culture as the authentic black culture, and that is seen in terms of music, food, but also a certain style, a certain kind of way of being. And that is a problem for upwardly mobile families that are mixed in terms of class, where you have people of different class positions or class origins in the same household. It also means that often in my research, white women of working class origin had less authority and were under more pressure than white women of middle class origin, because in some ways they had to compensate for their class background. And it's sort of a paradox, because England's not, because it's a class system, it's not segregated in quite the same way the U.S. is. Like, there is segregation, but it's more class-based. So white working class children growing up in the 70s and 80s were more likely to have black schoolmates or friends than in this country, and to have learned or been socialized into black Caribbean network. But that also could be held against them, right? And so it's a good question, because one of the ways it came up in my research is, did you learn to cook Jamaican food from your black mother-in-law or from a class? So if you went to a class to learn to cook, that wasn't authentic, because that was a middle-class way of learning, right? As opposed to if you learned to cook from your mother-in-law or sister-in-law. Does that make sense? Okay.
What a great paper. Is it? 108, that's a very impressive N for an anthropologist. So I'm wondering about pressure. There must be folks you've interviewed,
right,
where there was pressure from the white side of the family to not let the whiteness or Englishness or Irishness, whatever that bundle means,
right.
drop out. And
right.
it's very curious that, you know, the motivations for these white mothers to seek this. I mean, for any of us who are married, we know the pressures to be liked,
right?
By in-laws. But then also, regardless of difference and what that difference might be, mm-hmm. eventually in a marriage, a desire to be different from the in-laws. So I'm wondering about sort of pressures on both sides, and then when women sort of, you know, choose their own path. And then this conundrum of women who are single. So they don't, then they really have to, so the white women who don't have this female network and sort of female pressures, but also female mentoring on blackness, how they, I mean, it's counterintuitive that they would go out of their way to seek authentication.
Okay, so let me just clarify. There are two questions here. One question is, how did they negotiate pressures from both sides, or did I find pressure from both sides? Okay, so the pressure from both sides varied. Here was another paradox I found. In the case of women from working class backgrounds, I interviewed women from working class, middle class, and upper middle class backgrounds. Upper middle class would be defined as going to boarding school and, you know, inheriting wealth. And so I did have women who went to the top boarding schools in Scotland, and they were upper middle class. And middle class, usually, I let them self-identify and then explain to me why they had this class position. Working class families seem to have both. The women from working class families seem to have both more pressure from their family members, because there was more intimacy and more conflict. And some women, because I was going there for 10 years, I was able to see shifts. So in about half of the families, you know, marriages have a career, right? So you start off, and the things you're fighting about or issues in the early years aren't necessarily the same issues in the later years. So in the beginning, depending on whether the white side of the family accepted the marriage or relationship, that was linked to whether there was pressure and how much. So in some cases, a woman may be temporarily exiled or experience a form of social death. And literally, there were some families where the father actually told everyone, she died. She's no longer here, doesn't exist. In those cases, there's not a lot of pressure because there's no contact for a while. But sometimes that shifted back. So the pressure was often related to, A, the degree of overt racism and rejection. And then if they were able to negotiate that, then the pressure would increase to at least have a cultural hybrid. But the pressure was also linked to something that I hadn't thought about initially, which was how much of a friendship network, the degree of black women in the friendship network. So it's not just black sisters-in-law, but how many black friends do you have, and how many black friends does your white sister have? So let's say for a minute I'm white, and I grow up and I have black Jamaican friends, and so does my white sister. If my white sister and I share that, we can together construct a different or new meaning of Englishness that challenges our parents, right? And so then we've redefined what it means to have an English household, and there's less pressure because there's a new consensus about what English means. So English can be both roast beef and reggae, right? And so that's number one. So one of the things I found was that the friendship network, and whether you had a white sibling who either married, slept with, or had black friends, you know, just to simplify it, that was really significant. And I wouldn't have figured that out if I hadn't gone back for so long. Now, and by the way, this had no impact on the white men. I did interview white fathers, and they didn't have the same negotiations, in part because they didn't have to prove respectability, because the women, whether black or white, I interviewed black and white women in multiracial families to have a comparison group, and the women always took the hit for the most part. Single women, paradoxically, often had more support than the married women because the single women couldn't take for granted a network. And they actually often worked hard. First of all, they often acquired their children. How can I say this? Single women were more likely to have met the man who fathered their child through a black female friend, and were more likely to already be immersed in a black friendship network, which gave them a lot of support, and were often less isolated than married white middle class women who married a black guy but didn't necessarily have the friendship network. So often the single women had more female mentoring than the married women. Does that make sense? And I think part of that's because the single women were also more likely to be working class than, I had more class diversity among the married women. Does that make any sense? So did I answer your question? Okay. Next question.
More question. We will then take a 10-minute break and reconvene at 2:30 for our next presentation. And please help yourself to refreshments next door. Thank you all for coming.
Well, it's a privilege to get the last question. This was a wonderful talk. Thank you very much. I was thinking as I was listening to your examples of a parallel in the United States, less about the one that came to my mind was less between blacks and whites than between Jews and Christians. Oh. And a non-Jewish woman marrying into a Jewish family. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking here of the pressure, the fear of assimilation, and so the kind of pressure for that woman, and I think exactly what you're saying is true in terms of the woman getting the hit too, the pressure for the woman to learn these skills and ways in order to ensure that this Jewish identity doesn't disappear in generations to come. But I was thinking the place where the parallel doesn't quite fit, though, in the United States, at least in terms of intermarriage, thinking through the fact that for lots of the white mothers, they might presume that their children may not be welcomed into a white community.
Right.
And so in terms of that question of belonging, that, you know, that very powerful sense that you need to choose, you know, one or the other. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that. That's not necessarily a question, but I was thinking both of the parallel, and then also, is there that same sense in where you're studying in the UK that the mother has to choose? You know, either is this child going to be black British, or is this child going to be white British?
Thank you for that. That's a great question. And, you know, I just want to comment, there were some other parallels with the Jewish experience, which was there's a Saturday school that was similar to Hebrew school, where some of the women sent their children on Saturdays to learn black history and culture. Only one fourth of the women in my study did perform, you know, saw black women as their reference group. Three-fourths didn't. So the fear of assimilation really varied. One of the complications here is that it seemed that the British, the English women, less than Irish women, let me make a statement. Irish women were more likely to be more race aware because of their particular history with the English. So very different from like Irish Americans here. So the English women varied a lot in terms of whether they felt their children would be accepted or not. Women from middle and upper middle class backgrounds were more likely to think that if they just sent their kids to the right schools and trained them to behave properly, that the children would have a choice and that they wouldn't be rejected. And that's because their assumptions were that class trumps color. Working class people who were, quote, factory fodder, and basically whose parents had been part of the labor aristocracy, which fell apart after the 1970s, you know, under Thatcher, they were less likely to think that they didn't have class privilege, so they didn't think class would trump that because they didn't have the class privilege, and they were actually much more likely to fear that their children wouldn't be accepted because of class and color. But gender also played a role. For those families who had boys or only had male children, there was a much bigger fear that their child would be rejected, and so their experience was much more similar. The male experience for multiracial young men was much closer to the U.S. black experience, where young black men in our country are profiled and attacked by the police. So gender was really crucial. And so even within the same families, often that there would be more concerned about the male not being able to assimilate and less concerned about the girl. So it really varied a lot. Class was really crucial. And the majority of the women did feel that their children would have a choice because they felt British society was changing. Now, whether we believe that or not is a different case, but the majority, but class mediated that kind of belief that we can trump, that color can be minimized and isn't a significant marker, because class plays out differently in England than it does here. Did I answer your question? Okay, thank you.
Again, let's thank Professor Twine one more time. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really great.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll reconvene at 2:30 for Professor Hill's presentation of Karen Kelski's paper.